Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Keisha Morris, Program Associate with Common Cause, who talks about President Trump's continuing efforts to use citizenship data to give the Republican Party an advantage in the methods used to draw new electoral maps. Megan Goslin of Yale University's Child Study Center, who describes the health impacts of toxic stress on children torn away from their parents, and the urgent need to close down President Trump's inhumane immigration detention camps. And Stephen Miles, Executive Director of the National Coalition Win Without War, who discusses the significance of the House passage of a measure that would block funding for any future Trump-initiated war with Iran. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A month after a brutal crackdown in Sudan, a power-sharing agreement was negotiated between the ruling military council and a coalition of opposition civil society groups. The deal came after a weekend of mass protests and behind-the-scenes maneuvering by the United States and powerful Persian Gulf states. The accord establishes a sovereign council which will govern the nation for 3 years. The council will be led for the first 21 months by the military and for the final 18 months by civilians, leading to national elections. Both sides agreed to open an independent investigation into the brutal killing of 140 Sudanese civil society activists by pro-government paramilitary groups during a sit-in on June 3rd. Before the mass protests in Sudan, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia withdrew their financial support of Sudan's longtime dictator, Omar al-Bashir. They froze out Bashir for his unwillingness to break his alliance with Qatar and Islamists in his government who controlled key military and intelligence ministries. Amid mounting protests, the longtime dictator was overthrown in a coup in April, and the military council took over. During the mounting crisis, UAE officials reached out to opposition leaders in anticipation of a future without Bashir. The BBC reports that Sudan's opposition leaders are now concerned about the growing influence of Gulf states in Sudan's weak economy. The UAE is Sudan's largest export market. It buys most of the country's top money earner, gold, and Saudi Arabia is buying up livestock. In other sectors, Sudan is leasing millions of acres of agricultural land to Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Turkey, and China. Democrats running in the 2020 presidential campaign are proposing plans to address America's affordable housing crisis, which has been spreading into many rural areas. Thus far, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Julian Castro have released plans to increase the supply of affordable housing and strengthen protections for renters and homeowners. The plans call for an increase in funding for the Housing Trust Fund, which provides states funding to build new housing and maintain existing affordable units. Promoting affordable housing is good politics for progressives, as 38 million renters pay over 30% of their annual income on rent. An expansion in affordable housing would especially aid young people, city renters, and people of color. Lack of housing is hurting the economies of some rural red states, as new workers, such as nurses, factory workers, and managers, are reluctant to relocate to new cities without affordable housing options. Many housing activists worry about the legacy of racism in federal housing programs. Elizabeth Warren wants homeowners in historically redlined communities to be eligible for down payment assistance. Cory Booker proposed to initiate what he calls baby bonds, funds deposited into a low-risk savings account that would be given to every child in order to break up the racial wealth gap. Tohono O'odham Aboriginal land in what is now southern Arizona historically extended 175 miles into Mexico before being sliced off, without the tribe's consent, by the 1853 Gadsden Purchase Treaty. As many as 2,500 of the tribe's more than 30,000 members still live on the Mexico side of the border. Tohono O'odham people used to travel between the U.S. and Mexico fairly easily on roads without checkpoints to visit family, go to school, visit a doctor, or perform ceremonial duties. But incidents of U.S. Customs and Border Protection aggression toward members of the Tohono O'odham Nation have become increasingly frequent since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, as the Border Patrol has doubled in size and further militarized its border enforcement. In These Times magazine reports that in 2007 and 2008, the U.S. government built vehicle barriers on the Tohono O'odham Nation's stretch of the U.S.-Mexico border and restricted crossings by tribal members. However, on March 22nd, the Tohono O'odham Legislative Council passed a resolution allowing Customs and Border Protection to contract with the Israeli company Elbit Systems to build 10 integrated fixed towers, or IFTs, on the nation's land, surveillance infrastructure that many on the reservation see as a high-tech occupation. Amy Juan, Tohono's O'odham member and Tucson office manager at the International Indian Treaty Council, says the surveillance towers would make Tohono O'odham the most militarized community in the United States. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Although the Trump regime's drive to include a question on citizenship in the 2020 U.S. Census came to an end when the president held a press event on July 11th, he's still clearly determined to use citizenship data to give the Republican Party an advantage in the methods used to draw new electoral maps. Mr. Trump said he was issuing an executive order instructing federal departments and agencies to provide the Census Bureau with citizenship statistics from their databases, repeating a policy announced last year by the Commerce Department. It's clear that the president's ultimate goal is to eliminate non-voters from the population counts, used every 10 years, to draw new state and federal legislative district maps. During his talk in the White House Rose Garden, Mr. Trump said, quote, "Some states may want to draw state and local legislative districts based upon the voter-eligible population." According to research, political maps based on the population of citizens alone would produce an electorate that would be far less diverse than the nation as a whole, and in the words of the late GOP strategist Thomas Hoefler, advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. Your reporter spoke with Keisha Morris, program associate with Common Cause. Here she talks about the Trump regime's new effort to rig the electoral system and an Alabama federal lawsuit demanding that non-citizens not be counted for purposes of reapportionment and redistricting.
Late last week, Trump issued an executive order stating that, you know, they were giving up on adding a question on citizenship to the 20th Census form, but they're requiring all executive agencies to provide citizenship data to the Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau so that citizenship data could be added in what's called the PL94171 file, also called the redistricting file, that gets sent to the states after the census takes place. That data would likely be used at the request of map makers in the state to redistrict using citizen voting age population. So anyone that is not a citizen, anyone that's under the age of 18, we will likely see in 2021 after redistricting, unless, you know, some advocacy or court stop this ahead of this happening, we will likely see map makers trying to draw district lines at the state or even federal level that excludes non-citizens and those under the age of 18. That would dramatically change how our district lines are drawn right now. It will exclude millions of people from the representation process, and Common Cause and other groups are working right now to, you know, make sure that people across the country are aware of this plot and are also advocating to their state legislatures to make sure that total population and no other citizen voting age data is used for the redistricting process.
So, Keisha, who would be the winners and who would be the losers in a Trump-imagined system that you just laid out for us, using only eligible voters to be counted when new district lines are drawn up?
Well, you know, thanks to the work of litigators in the Common Cause, the Lewis case, we know exactly who would benefit. Just a couple weeks ago, we were able to obtain some documents by a gentleman named Thomas Hoffler. He was a GOP redistricting strategist that drew district lines in North Carolina and a number of other states. But in his files, after he just passed away late last year, we were able to obtain files from a study that he did in 2015 that pretty much laid out who would win if citizen voting age population was used in redistricting. In his words, redistricting based off the citizen voting age population would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. So anyone that's outside of those two labels would absolutely be the losers if this was to go forward.
So Keisha, what has the Supreme Court said about this, I think, quite radical plan to change the way states use population data to draw up new legislative district lines, both statewide and federal?
In 2016, in Evanwell v. Abbott, the Supreme Court upheld the use of total population for state legislative districts and also congressional districts. However, they did leave open the possibility that citizen voting age population could be used if it was done.
And as I understand it, Keisha, there is a pending federal court case in Alabama that is trying to achieve that very goal in that state. And of course, that could spread to other Republican-controlled states all across the country if it exceeds in that federal court.
Absolutely. Part of that lawsuit is also that only citizens should be counted in the census as well. But yeah, that is something that is proceeding currently. It was brought by Representative Mo Brooks, a representative in Alabama, and is being fought actually by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And it is proceeding actually rather slowly. But yeah, we will see what happens. But as I said, Common Cause, we are definitely advocating for the use of total population in drawing district lines.
That was Keisha Morris, Program Associate with Common Cause. Learn more about what the Trump regime and Republican Party are doing to gerrymander state and federal districts nationwide to favor GOP candidates by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 800 rallies were held around the world on July 12th, mostly in the U.S., demanding that the Trump regime shut down their immigrant detention camps, labeled by many critics as concentration camps. The Lights for Liberty Global Action, organized by national, regional, and local groups, called on Americans to uphold human rights and the fundamental principle behind democracy, that all human beings have a right to life, liberty, and dignity. Thousands gathered on July 12th to protest the inhumane conditions and denial of basic needs, such as adequate food, water, and sanitation, faced by refugees in detention camps on the U.S.-Mexico border and elsewhere across the country. Hundreds of people attended a rally in Hamden, Connecticut, near the city of New Haven, which is home to many undocumented residents. The action was organized by staff members at the Yale University Child Study Center, which has a long history of treating children who've experienced trauma. We hear from one of the speakers, Megan Goslin, a clinical psychologist who works in the center's childhood violent trauma section. Here she describes the short-term and long-term health impacts of toxic stress on children torn away from their parents and the urgent need to end family separation and close down the detention centers.
And so we rallied and we called and we said, families belong together. And certainly that is true. But immigrants' rights groups were urgently warning everyone, don't make the messaging so narrow. They were reminding us that incarcerating children with or without their parents is a violation of their fundamental human rights. And so here we are today, watching in horror as our country, in our name, both keeps children from their caregivers and locks men, women, and children in conditions that lack basic fundamental necessities like adequate food, water, soap, toothbrushes, and beds. I've been asked to arm us very briefly with the science behind traumatic family separation and detention. And the reality is that the science tells us what I feel to be true as an activist. In fact, each of you already instinctively knows the science. You already know it in your hearts and in the pit of your stomachs, without needing to hear about the decades of research. You know it when your eyes well up as you imagine a breastfeeding baby being ripped from his mother's arms. You know it when you become overwhelmed by rage as you picture a 5-year-old child being asked to take on the responsibility of diapering, feeding, and comforting an inconsolable 2-year-old. You know it when your heart aches at the idea of a 4-year-old who's wondering whether her mom and dad don't want her anymore. Maybe that's why they haven't come to get me. You know it as you imagine a father sick with worry tonight because he doesn't know if his son is hungry, if he's scared, if he's hurt. He doesn't know who's taking care of him. And more than anything, he just longs to be able to hold his son and tell him everything is gonna be okay. And you already know this science because your body instinctively responds to these images with disgust, with outrage, and with great, great sadness. Many years ago in our country, we made a decision as a society to put an end to orphanages as a strategy for caring for kids who don't have parents or guardians. We made that decision for both moral and scientific reasons, because we know that children in group care settings do not thrive, particularly young children. In fact, early and pervasive stressors like childhood detention can contribute to both structural and functional changes in the brain. They can lead to fundamental alterations and dysregulation in the way our bodies respond to future stress. And when left untreated, these changes can last a lifetime, with devastating consequences for health, development, and well-being. So what do these children need to recover? First and foremost, they need the danger to end. So in this case, that means the immediate release from detention and reunification with caregivers. Because in times of the very worst stress, children use their parents as a buffer against what's happening around them. So by keeping children in conditions of toxic stress without access to their lifelines, their caregivers, we are inflicting double the damage. We are withholding the very medicine that they need to begin to heal. And that can never be safe, and it can never be sanitary. That is why scientific, medical research, and human rights organizations across the globe have warned of the traumatic and moral implications of family separation and detention. And for those of us in the medical and scientific communities, I think we need to raise our voices even louder, and I think we need to be unrelenting. We could just show up at rallies and think that our job is done. And if we do that, then we certainly have failed. Instead, we need to partner in a sustained and meaningful way with immigrants' rights groups who are busy doing this work every single day, whether immigration is on the front page or not. We need to flood our representatives with calls that demand immediate oversight, adequate funding, and release of kids and families from detention. We need to do it now because every day matters. We need to donate to people on the ground at the border providing legal assistance to the detained and separated kids and families. We need to demand the immediate reunification of kids separated from their caregivers. And we need to provide access to early intervention for those reunited families to support the kids and the adults in their recovery from these traumas. We need to do all this, and we need to do it more, and we need to do it yesterday. And most importantly, we cannot allow this administration to weaponize parental love in an effort to deter desperate families from taking desperate measures in search of a better life. Instead, we need to weaponize our love, our compassion, and our empathy for our fellow human beings. So I ask you, gather up your love and demand that the traumas of family detention and separation end now. And know that every day apart and every day behind bars matters. These children are calling out for their mothers, and they are also calling out for each of us. Thank you.
That was Megan Goslin, Associate Research Scientist at Yale University's Child Study Center. Speaking at a Lights for Liberty rally in Hamden, Connecticut on July 12th, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about groups working to shut down inhumane detention centers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After months of escalating tension between the Trump regime and Iran, with a recent threat of war breaking out narrowly averted, the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives passed two measures that would rein in the president's ability to initiate a U.S. military attack against Tehran. Democrats, joined by more than two dozen Republicans, approved the Khanna-Gates Amendment to the $730 billion National Defense Authorization Act by a vote of 251 to 170 that would prevent federal funds from being used for any military force in or against Iran without congressional authorization. The measure also clarifies that neither the 2001 nor 2002 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF, can be invoked to justify the use of military force against Iran. The Second Amendment mandates the U.S. military withdraw aid to the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, deemed by the United Nations as one of the worst humanitarian disasters in the world today. This amendment is a follow-up measure to the historic invocation of the War Powers Resolution, passed by both the House and Senate in April, but later vetoed by Trump. But because the new House amendments are sure to be opposed by the Republican majority in the Senate and face a presidential veto, these measures likely won't have the force of law anytime soon. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Miles, executive director of the National Coalition Win Without War. Here he discusses the significance of the passage of these measures and growing public opposition to the launching of a new U.S. war against Iran.
You know, I think your listeners will remember we came within minutes of the U.S. being involved in a major war with Iran not all that long ago. We still don't know all the details of what happened, but it does appear that one way or another, the president ultimately decided not to engage militarily at that moment after the downing of a U.S. drone. But we still remain precariously close to a military conflict in the Middle East, in particular in the U.S. against Iran. We know that the president surrounded himself with a war cabinet of folks like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, who have been just, you know, lusting for war, in the case of Bolton, publicly and openly for years and years and years. And we know that his cabinet was fully committed to supporting the military action back when it almost happened not that long ago. And so we're working with a number of members of Congress, but really members of Congress themselves saw what was happening and decided to do something we haven't seen a lot of in recent history, which was really put their foot down and make clear that they intend to assert their constitutional rights. You know, the Constitution is actually crystal clear that it's the United States Congress, not the president, who gets to decide where and when our nation goes to war. The founders of our country put that power in Congress because they wanted it to be difficult. They knew that members of Congress would fight with each other, they would disagree, it would be hard to go to war. And they knew, based on their own experience living in an era of kings and despots, that when you had that power in one individual's hands, it was too easy for a whole entire nation to go to war. So they gave that power to Congress. We've seen that erode. And now what we're seeing is a resurgence of congressional interest in asserting their war powers. And as you mentioned, this year is part of the National Defense Authorization Act, the annual defense policy bill. We saw a successful effort in the House, as well as a bipartisan majority of senators. It takes 60 votes in the Senate, so it didn't reach that threshold. But bipartisan majorities in both chambers putting their foot down and saying, we will not allow you to spend one penny of taxpayer dollars on a war that has not been authorized by Congress, and that there is no authorization currently on the books for you, Mr. President, to take us to war with Iran.
Stephen, what is the effect of the legislation passed in the House without a similar passage in the Senate? It sends a message, but is there any effective obstacle to Trump going to war at this point if he decides to initiate a new conflict with Iran?
Well, but I think it's a great question, and I think we have to be really clear here. And I think the sponsors were clear during the debate, but we're talking about the kinds of ins and outs of federal legislation. It can get a bit confusing. So it's worth remembering this kind of a military attack would already be illegal. As I said, the Constitution gives the power alone to Congress, and Congress has not authorized any such military mission. So this is what you might consider a kind of belt and suspenders type situation. It's already illegal, but this is Congress saying we've seen this administration far too often do things that are illegal. And in the case of a war, there's no court injunction that's going to stop it. It very quickly can spiral out of control. So what we want to do is we want to go ahead and block the funding that could be used for that war before it even starts. Now, the House passed that. As I said, the Senate had a bipartisan majority to pass very similar legislation. But the House and the Senate do have different bills. So right now what has to happen is a process in Washington called going to conference. The House and the Senate bills are different in many different ways. This is only one of them. And over the next several weeks, they'll look to make those bills the same. And then ultimately they have to pass them through both chambers again and then get to the president and be signed into law. The reason it was so important to do this on this piece of legislation is this is what's called considered must-pass legislation. The National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, has passed for the last 58 years running every year. So this is something that people are really reluctant not to see become law. And there's a very strong possibility that while the Senate didn't put this in their bill, because they did have a bipartisan majority vote for essentially the same thing, what we're hopeful for is that the final bill will contain this language. But we've got a long way to go. We haven't gotten there yet, and the next couple weeks is going to decide how we get there.
That was Stephen Miles, Executive Director of the National Coalition, Win Without War. Find more analysis and commentary on the House amendments to prevent a new war with Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on RECFM in Riverton, Maryland, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KSER in Everett, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.